We're going to pick it up in verse 45, where it says, immediately, a favorite word in Mark, by the way, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. I've heard all kinds of sermons on Jesus walking on the water. Well, you're going to hear another one today. So, again, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida. Well, he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the water, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, that would be somewhere between 3 in the morning and 6 in the morning, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them. The word meant is the Greek word thelo. It literally means he desired. Strange saying, isn't it? He meant or desired to pass by them, but when he saw them walking in the sea, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost. That's the word we get our English word, phantom. And they cried out, literally they shrieked, for they saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid. Now, at this juncture, Matthew's rendering of this story inserts the story of Peter saying to Jesus, well, Lord, can I walk on the water? And Jesus says, come on. He gets out of the boat. You remember the story. Walks on the water, sees the winds and the waves contrary, gets his eyes off Jesus, begins to sink, cries out for Jesus to save him, and he does. And Jesus says, you were doing so good. Well, you know, sort of. Why did you doubt? It's interesting, isn't it, that Mark's gospel, Mark gets his information for his gospel from Peter. But he doesn't put it in there. Interesting. Anyway, we'll pick it up verse 51. And he, Jesus, got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves. Interesting phrase, isn't it? But their hearts were hardened. Admittedly, this is another familiar miracle to many of you. But if you'll zoom in with me, you might learn, as I did, some things from this miracle that will challenge you in this regard, that you and I must trust Jesus in our struggles, not just the big ones, but the little ones as well. Let's be realistic. Most of your life is not made up of life and death situations. Would you agree with that? Most of your life is just made up of all kinds of stressors, struggles, little difficulties, irritants. Call them whatever you want. But they're not life and death. They're day-to-day tests. They're day-to-day stressors. They're day-to-day little wrestling matches with something that might only occur, might only take 5 seconds, but it's a struggle. And I'm here to say to you this morning that you need Jesus in those little times. Every one of your struggles, are designed by God to strengthen you, to toughen you, to mature you, to take you out of your selfish little impish immaturity that so often you exhibit in those little times of stress. Not all of you, but probably many of us. And they're designed to put steel into your faith, to be able to see what things are eternal versus temporal. The Bible tells us that we're confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion till the day of Christ Jesus. And in bringing it to completion, he's taken you through these little trials to mature you. The writer of Hebrews gets into the depth of this when he says in chapter 12, in verses 10 and 11, these words, he says, they, that's our earthly fathers, disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them. Now, you know, earthly dads, we can all relate to this. We blow it once in a while. Never God, right? But he, God, disciplines us for our good that we may share his holiness. There's the purpose in the disciplines and struggles of life. For the moment, all discipline seems painful, and all God's people said, rather than pleasant. But later, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been gymnasio. That's our word, gymnasium. We've been trained by it. It's all a part of the training in the school of Christ. So, with that in mind, let me point something out to you as we get going in our coverage of this miracle. Something you might not have noticed. In fact, most of the commentators didn't notice this. I think it's because on the surface, this miracle on the sea looks like some of the other life and death situations. And this storm looks like another mesoscale convective system, you know, ready to swamp them. Some kind of a Goliath over Galilee. And once again, Jesus' disciples are in the middle. Oh my goodness, come save them, Jesus. Not the case. And if you just read it carefully, you can see it's not the case. Look at verse 48, for instance. And he, that's Jesus, he's up on that mountainside praying, looking down on them. Look at it. He saw that they were making headway painfully. The wind was against them. Now, I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound like a life and death situation to me. Sounds like a struggle. I don't want to diminish this struggle. And in fact, in John chapter 6, it says they took off at about evening time, which starts at 6 in the night. So, I don't know, maybe it was 6, maybe it was 7. Let's just say it was 7 o'clock. Jesus launches them off. It's now the fourth watch. It's somewhere between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. They've been wrestling now for 8 to 10 plus hours in this wind. They were struggling. They were working. The sail was down. The oars are out. The spray's coming in. They're probably soaked. They're probably chilled. They're undoubtedly exhausted. The winds are contrary. But their lives were not in danger. Let me say that again. They were in a wrestling match, but their lives were not in danger. There is nothing in this text to indicate that this storm was anything of the ferocity of the one we saw earlier where they're in the boat, they're going to die, they're crying out to Jesus, save us, we're going to perish. Nothing like that. Well, what's, you might be thinking, well, why are you pointing this out? Why point this out? Because that is the point of this miracle. The point is they still needed Jesus. And so do you. And so do I. Not just in the life and death wrestling matches of life, of which we all have maybe one or two, but in the many struggles and all of those vicissitudes in between that we so often lose and do not demonstrate the life of sanctification and maturity. If you'll recall where we left off, the feeding of the 5,000 has just occurred, which is really probably the feeding of the 10,000 or even more perhaps. And there is this swell of messianic fervor that takes place. John's gospel of this account tells us that they tried to do a coup d'etat. They tried to grab Jesus, make him king. He's our man. And I mean, everything about this, I mean, this is arguably the high point of popularity for Jesus right here. It would be a day later before those people would bug out. But at this time, Jesus just basically, and there's speculation here as to what he was doing. He didn't maybe want his disciples caught up in all of that. So he puts them in the boat. In fact, you see the word made in verse 45. It's a very strong word. It means to compel. It even indicates that they were somewhat reluctant to get into that boat. But it's possible Jesus didn't want them caught up in all this messianic fervor. He sends them off. These guys were seasoned sailors. The wind may have already been kicking up. They might have been thinking, this is probably not a good idea for us to go across there now. But he has them do it. And so, this is the background of what's going on here. Jesus then not just dismisses his disciples. The text says he dismisses the crowd. Then he himself slips away and goes up on a mountainside to pray, to get alone. Perhaps just to sort of squelch all of that fervor that was going on. But he had much bigger things in mind when it came to his disciples. So these guys are into a rough trip, and here's the point. Jesus sends them out knowingly, willed them into a struggle. Please make a note of that. Jesus knowingly willed them into a struggle. Not the first time he'd done it. And he's done it in your life as well. Here's the first thing I want you to note and mark down today. God's will is not always the safest place, but it is always the right place. God's will is not always the safest place, but it is always the right place. Your struggle, your hardship, your difficulty does not necessarily indicate that you're out of God's will. It may very well indicate just the opposite. That God is trying to forge and form something within you. This business of God's will being the safest place is ludicrous. It's unbiblical. It makes no sense. When somebody says to you, well, God's will is the safest place to be, you tell them that's a lie. God's will isn't the safest place to be. It's just the right place to be. And that's all that matters. That is all that matters. Count the martyrs over the century who were clearly in the center of God's will and they died for the cause of Christ. And so you see all these pictures. Artists have depicted pictures of these disciples on the water. Storms of life. Many a sermon have been preached. You know, trusting Jesus in the storms of life. I'm talking about trusting Jesus in the struggles. In fact, the early artist and the early church really pictured the church as those 12 disciples. And the boat as being their place of gathering, so to speak. So in other words, this area we're in right now, we call it sometimes the sanctuary or the auditorium. Whatever that means, they would call it the ship. They would literally call this time together the ship. In fact, so much so that the term they used later on found its way into the English language. You have the word narthex, which is the foyer area, and how many have heard of the word the nave? You've heard the word the nave? That's this area right here. We talk about the naval academy. Nave means, it's a Latin word which means ship. And The early church saw the church not as this smooth sailing thing, but as a struggling ship being tossed about with the winds and whatever, always, always in need of Jesus. The good times, the horrific times, and every time in between. Remember, verse 48 says he saw them making headway painfully. This is at least a 9-hour ordeal. And where is Jesus during this time? Well, he's up on a mountainside, and he's watching them. John tells us they're 3 or 4 miles out. This is either another miracle, or he had some really, really good eyesight, because he's watching them. And I think it's interesting what Jesus was observing. Please notice this with me, if you will. He isn't just watching them, but he is observing that they are making headway painfully. Now, either this is really mean of Jesus, or he's got some point in all of this. They were making headway. Did you see it? They're making headway. Just not much. And there's no indication in any of the accounts that they ever cried out for help. That's why I say this wasn't life and death. It's just a big struggle. But let me just give you a word of encouragement. Here's a second thing I want you to note. This would be an encouragement to those of you who love Jesus. You might lose your focus on Jesus, but he will never lose his focus on you. You might lose your focus on Jesus. I might lose my focus on Jesus in all these little struggles. And wouldn't you agree that sometimes we do? It doesn't take something ginormous to cause us to lose focus. But he never loses his focus on you. Like the account of Peter, who loses focus on Jesus as he's walking on the water toward him and starts to sink. But Jesus never lost focus on him. And don't cave into the idea, well, one victory or, you know, one struggle won't necessarily lead to another. Oh, really? I mean, you know, here a while later, here's Peter warming his hands in front of a fire, denying Jesus one time after another. And just as the cock is ready to crow, Luke's gospel says, quote, "And the Lord looked at him." It had to be a painful look. Peter lost his focus on Jesus, but Jesus never lost his focus on Peter. He doesn't lose his focus on you and me either. Of course, if you're really, really good at what you do, and a lot of you are, you're really good businessmen. You're really good workers. Whatever you do, you're a gal that can just, you're one of these women that can just, you can take a list of 15 things and get them done in 2 hours because you're so good at what you do. Some of you have experienced, you who are really good at what you do, you've experienced this, where you make headway painfully, but you lose focus because it's all about you and your abilities. Listen, I don't want to heap a guilt trip on you. Be glad for this. Jesus doesn't lose focus on you. And he might be allowing you to struggle just so that you will come to a point where you'll say, "Help me." And so it tells us that he came to them. Just says it right there in the text, verse 48. Making their way painfully, winds against them, fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. Now, here's another thing I want you to mark down. Jesus will come to you when he sees you've exhausted all of your efforts. Jesus will come to you when he sees that you have exhausted all of your efforts. When did Jesus come to them? He watched them the whole time. He let them go for 9 hours plus, struggling, making headway, barely. Can you imagine how exhausted they must have been? Our guys from Togo could probably tell a few stories along this line, I'm sure. But how about one from our own stay-at-homers? I don't mean the women, just some of who didn't go to Togo. But his heart was there, Art Cross. Art Cross has been our mission guy for like 114 years or something. And if you know Art, he can do it all. He does do it all. This guy's closer to 90 than he is 80, but he's still, you know, working all the vehicles around here. He's fixed all of our cars 3 or 4 times. And he doesn't need a whole lot of help around the place because he just does it. We offered help him, but he doesn't need it. And he's told him, when I need it, I'll let you know. I got his permission to share this, by the way. So, last week, I wondered where Kevin was. He was gone. He finally shows up, and Kevin is just giddy. He's giddy with excitement. I said, what are you excited about? Kevin says, Art called me up to come help him. You're kidding! He didn't call me! We all wanted in on it because Art's helped us so many times. And Kevin told the story. Apparently Art's garage door didn't work. Something was busted. You know Art would have fixed it if he could have got on the inside to do it, but he couldn't get the thing up. So apparently he's using jacks and all kinds of stuff to get that garage door open. But for the life of himself, Art can't get that garage door up. And so he calls Kevin. And Kevin dropped everything and ran to Art with excitement. Art had exhausted all of his efforts. And Kevin was happy to go. I think that that's exactly where we are with our relationship with Christ sometimes. Jesus waits and watches and prays for you and for me as we struggle. But he lets us struggle because he wants us to come to the end of ourselves so that we will constantly be trusting him and call upon him. In fact, they hadn't done that yet. Listen to what Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. He said, "For we do not want you to be ignorant, brothers, of the afflictions we experience in Asia. For we were utterly burdened beyond our strength and were despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death, but that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. He delivered us from such a deadly peril, and he will deliver us. On him we have set our hope that he will deliver us again." God purposely puts us through these wrenching struggles so that we will realize that we need him all the time. And he will come to us when we have exhausted all of these efforts. And so he does come to them. And of course, when they see him, they scream like little girls. Then again, I don't know, wiped out, 3 a.m., guy comes walking on the water, might be a little freaky. And what does Jesus do? Well, he does what he does for us today. He comforts them with his word, right? He speaks to them, just like God does to us when we come to him in his word. He speaks to us, and he comforts us. He gets in, the wind dies down, another miracle, and if you read John's account, the boat suddenly appears on land. A third miracle. You know this thing has all been fixed. If they're out in the middle of it, they're fighting, struggling, and everything, Jesus gets on, boom, they're on land. It's like, which magnifies the whole thing, was a test. You know, the writer of Proverbs says, if we faint in the day of adversity, our strength is what? It's small, it's weak. And Jesus could take all of that stress and struggle out of your trial, but you'd never grow, would you? You'd never advance in your walk with God if he didn't sit up there on that mountainside called heaven and just watch. Sometimes he's doing that. He's not doing it because he takes joy necessarily in our struggle, but because he knows it's what's best for us. But he'll come when we're at the end of ourselves. And Mark adds a little addendum here. It's worth noting. It says in verse 52 that they did not, notice that, they did not understand about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Remember, if you were with us last week, we asked the question, how many aha moments does it take for us to get it? How many times in our life does God got to intercede, show us that he was there the whole time, that he was watching? He might have exposed you in a sin. He might have just came through and blessed you at the last possible moment. And you went, oh my goodness, I can trust him. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, you're right back in the same spot. How many aha moments does it take for us to realize we need him all the time? Here's the last thing I want you to note, and here it is. If you don't learn from the lessons of the past, you'll struggle with the ones God's teaching you now. That's what this is all about. They didn't understand the loaves. What's that all about? That goes back a day. That's the whole feeding of the 5,000 thing. I know. God knows. You should know. If you don't learn the lessons of the past in your life, you will struggle with the ones God's taking you through right at this very moment. It's humbling for me to look at my life and the times that I have, or perhaps I am, rowing on my own, so to speak. Making progress, but painstakingly little. Can you relate to that? In all of these areas, in all of these times, I needed help. I needed Jesus. Not only in life's storms, but in life's struggles as well. In what areas of your life are you living right now as if you don't need Jesus? Oh, you'd never say that. Never. You'd never say, I don't need Jesus. That'd be blasphemous. That'd be sacrilegious. Perish the thought. But you're living like you don't need him. You know, because that's something I can handle. That's an area, you know, I can handle this one, God. You know, it's like when you say to somebody who offers to help you, you say, oh yeah, I could use your help. What are you saying? You're saying, I can do this. If you want to help, okay. Isn't that kind of what you're saying? Or worse, I don't need your help at all. And so many of us do that with God. Years ago, I heard Chuck Swindoll preach a message that literally rocked my world. I referred to it a few weeks back, but this is a different element of that message. He preached on Uzziah, the godly king of Judah. Do you remember? You ever remember reading about Uzziah? He was an outstanding king of Judah. In fact, if it weren't for the end of his life, there'd be a bunch of little Uzziahs running around here. I'm absolutely confident of that. We'd be naming our kids after him. But if you know the story, after this incredible reign, lengthy reign, this guy was so godly, such a wonderful testimony for God, that when he died, Isaiah went into a spirit of depression. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. Remember that? He references a time that he's really down after this lengthy, prosperous, outstanding reign. But he got to a point where he got so big that the only thing missing was the privileges of the priesthood, and the Bible tells us he went into the temple and tried to offer incense. You don't do that unless you're a priest. The priest tries, no, Uzziah, it's not for you to do that. And he just stubbornly went forth, and God smote Uzziah with leprosy on his head, and he ended up dying later on in isolation. A sad ending to an otherwise fabulous life. Swindoll preached a message on that, and I don't remember what the title or even the sub, but if it was subtitled, it was something like Signs That You're in Trouble. And I finish it with this. Swindoll, and this is what rocked my world, because I was young, I was vivacious, I just had all the energy in the world to get after things. I'd only been a pastor for about a year and a half or two. Swindoll said, in the light of Uzziah's life, he said, you know you're in trouble when God's help is nice, but not absolutely necessary. You know you're in trouble when God's help is nice, but it's not absolutely necessary. Let's pray. Well, what do you think of that? What do you think of that last line, huh? What do you think? Think about it. Is that you? Does that describe you, friend? Oh, yeah, you could use God's help. It'd be nice if you could, you know, just sort of tag along once in a while when needed. You're in trouble. You are in trouble if God's help is nice, but it's not absolutely necessary. And this is the lesson of this miracle. This is the lesson that God is not just the God of big things, big trials, big needs, but he's God overall, so he's God in the little things too. And you need him in those times. If you have lived a life as a follower of Christ, as one who would stubbornly go it on your own, without this constant awareness that you need him, why don't you confess that right now as you sit? Some of you are here and you're not a Christian. You know you're not a Christian. And it'd be nice for God to help you. Are you kidding? God is against you right now. His wrath is abiding upon you right now. And yet his help is available. The help is in the cross. You place your trust in Jesus. And he comes to you. You cry out like Peter, Lord, save me. I'm sinking in my sin. And you believe that Jesus died and rose for you. And you know what? He'll put you in the boat, so to speak. Father, thank you for the lessons of life in the miracles of the miracle man himself, Jesus. We pray in his name. Amen. Let's all stand. As we sing this song, my guess is that some of you, if you're being honest, you're thinking, wow, he just described me. No, the Bible just described you. We're all struggling. All of us are. We all have the contrary winds in our lives. But it just described you as one. You're making progress, but painstakingly so, because you're really not trusting Jesus. You're not showing that you need him in those. And maybe you would admit today that you do. You just need to talk to God while we sing. We invite you to come forward and do so.
Thank you. We'd like to thank you for listening to our weekly podcast. We'd also like to invite you to visit our website at www.sailorvillebaptist.com. Drop us a line and let us know how we can serve you better. We'll see you next week.